and welcome to the Product Science Podcast, where we're helping startup founders and product leaders build high-growth products, teams, and companies through real conversations with people who have tried it and aren't afraid to share lessons learned from their failures along the way. I'm your host, Holly Hester Riley, founder and CEO of H2R Product Science. This week on the Product Science Podcast, I'm excited to share a conversation with Robbie Kelman-Baxter. Robbie has more than 20 years of experience providing strategic business advice to major organizations, including Netflix, Fitbit, Microsoft, and Consumer Reports. She's been focused on subscription and growth strategies for the past decade. She has been featured in the Wall Street Journal and on CNN, and she has her MBA from the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and she graduated with honors from Harvard College. So welcome.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to have this conversation with you. So, as you know, this is a product management podcast, and obviously subscriptions are huge in the world of all of the things that we do in product management. So I'm super excited to talk to you and hear more about how you think about subscriptions and the membership economy, and also just your journey, like how you got to where you are. It sounds fascinating. So if you could actually take us back in time a bit, I would love to start with a bit more of your journey. How did you get started working with these, you know, companies like this, and how did you, what was your path to that?
Yeah. So out of college, I was a strategy consultant for Booz Allen Hamilton, big strategy for what they called marketing intensive companies. So companies where sales and marketing matters, where they're not, you know, they're not oil refineries, they don't have patents or regulatory advantages. And from there, I went to business school, spent 5 years working in product marketing, and I got laid off. I'm in Silicon Valley. I live in Menlo Park, California. And, 5 years into that, I got laid off while I was on maternity leave. And I know, totally legal, but really a bummer, very bad timing. And I said, okay, I need to be in control of my own career. Meaning the only person, when you're a consultant, when you're in a company, there's a million factors that go into your career and whether or not you move up, whether or not you get laid off, that are out of your control. When you're a consultant, you really only have to satisfy your client. So I said, okay, that's a much clearer path for me for right now. I'm going to do this for a little while to pay our mortgage, and then I'll figure out what I'm going to do later. Like I'll give myself 3 to 5 years when the kids are out of diapers. And as I got into consulting, I realized that if I wanted to stay in consulting, if I wanted to go more than that 3 to 5 year period, I either needed to grow a firm, which was not something that excited me at all, or I needed to become an expert. Otherwise, you're just a pair of arms and legs. You're a contractor. And there's no shame in being a contractor. It's a very good lifestyle for a lot of people, and it, you know, works really well. But for me, I really wanted to be an expert in something and provide advice, in kind of the true consultative fashion. So I started looking for something I could be an expert about. And, you know, it's not as easy as it sounds because, you know, you can't really be, it's hard to be an expert on all things strategy or all things product or all things, you know, finance. And then if you do something narrow, it's either too narrow to be relevant or too narrow to be interesting. So it took me a while. And my fifth client was Netflix. So this is way back when I was getting started, and I fell in love with their business model. I loved how they did one thing really well, which was, you know, I would call it, you know, wide selection of professionally created content delivered with cost certainty in the most efficient way possible. And I loved how they used that as their North Star, and how even, you know, back in those early days that they had 3 DVDs out at a time, they were already thinking about streaming and downloading, and they were thinking about what would it look like if it, you know, the content came through your gaming console, or what if it came through your computer, and eventually what if it came through your phone or your smart TV. And I loved how they turned down money when it wasn't aligned with that promise that they were making to their customers. So they didn't do video games. They didn't sell guides to books. They didn't sell TV programs. Like you can't buy, if you watch a video that you like on Netflix, you can't buy it from Netflix. That's not something they do. And so anyway, as I was falling in love with Netflix and kind of interested in their model, other people were. And I started getting calls from SaaS companies who were saying, you know, our model's not quite working. We want to be more like Netflix, or other content companies that said they want to be more like Netflix. And then it got really crazy, right? I started getting calls from, you know, we make dental pain management products like anesthesias. We want to be like Netflix. We make bicycles. We want to be like Netflix.
Wow.
And I started, you know, I doubled down on that space, and I started looking for and trying to define where the similarities were and where the differences were across these different industries, these different maturity levels, and what was it that I could bring when somebody said, we want to work with you because you worked at Netflix, or because you worked at SurveyMonkey, or you worked with Electronic Arts, or you worked with, you know, any of the companies that I worked with, what did that really mean? And that's how I started, you know, really writing. And that's kind of the beginning of my book, The Membership Economy, and kind of what brought me here.
Yeah, awesome. Help us understand. I think Netflix is an, you know, a Goliath at this point in the tech world. And help us understand sort of what piece of their journey you were on the ground for. Like, where were they at then? Were they still doing DVDs? Had they already transitioned fully? What did that look like?
Yeah, so this was 2001 to 2003 that I was working with Netflix. And they were, let's see, where were they? They were just finally establishing a national footprint. So, I mean, crazy to think. I mean, people always think of Netflix, as you said, as this Goliath, but they were still trying to get enough distribution centers so that they could serve the entire country, right? Because they promised three DVD, you know, the DVD would take 3 days to return. So you'd send your DVD back and you'd get the new DVD within 3 days. And they couldn't do that everywhere. So I was just there when they were getting that national footprint. So they were launching national advertising. So I was there for that. I was there. They were researching and experimenting and thinking about streaming. They were getting into the content world. They didn't have their own content, but they were attending Sundance every year. They had hired a team of people to look into content, but it was still very much three DVDs out at a time. And the work I was doing with them was around acquisition. So they had all of these, as many organizations do, all of these partners that said, hey, we, or not even partners, wannabe partners who said, hey, we love what you're doing. We have an idea of how we could work with you. What if we gave away subscriptions with our, you know, bank accounts? What if we gave away subscriptions with our bicycles? What if you gave away our books with your subscriptions? What if you gave away our televisions with your subscriptions? You know, all these different ideas that people were presenting. And what I loved about Netflix is they were so clear on who would make a good partner and how to value the success of a partnership. Very data-driven, but also very long-term focused. And I think this is a key point about subscriptions that, you know, many businesses are all about the acquisition, right? The new logo, the new customers, that's what boards want to talk about, right? Show me your new logos. That's sexy. That's fun. That's exciting. But Netflix understood that the sexy part was retention, and that what that means is, first of all, you want to track retention. It also means you want to design your product for retention, not just for those headline benefits that get someone to buy, but those benefits that you can't really even talk about. Like, nobody cares about them in the selling phase, but they're the benefits that actually help somebody make a product a habit and increase the likelihood of them staying. And Netflix was very, very focused on, you know, we only want to attract and transact with customers who we are confident are going to stay.
Yeah, that's so powerful. I think there's a lot of things in what you just said that really resonate for me. The first one just being the impact of having a long-term strategy and having that vision and that picture of who their ideal customer is. And, you know, I work with a lot of people who struggle with that because they want to say yes to everything. Is that something that you see as well? And how do you work with that?
Yeah, it's so funny, Holly. You know, I was talking to a client recently. They have 25 people on their team, just to give you a sense of scale. And I asked them, who's their customer, and they said they're in the HR space, and they said any company that wants to serve their employees well. I was like, seriously, yeah. Any customer, any company in the whole country? This is just, you know, United States only. Yeah. But it's just, it's interesting how, you know, so many companies say, well, our product could be good for anybody. Mm-hmm. And how scary it is. I mean, it's scary for me as a consultant. I remember, you know, saying to people, you know, I'm not going to do work for you if it's not, this is what I do. I do membership. I do subscription. If I do long-term relationships, if you don't believe in long-term relationships, I am not your gal. It's very hard to turn away business up front. It's also, you know, hard to know when someone walks in the front door, how long they're going to stay. It takes a very different way of thinking about a customer, because it's not just about what's going to make them buy. It's understanding, and this is even more complicated in a B2B world, but what's going to make them adopt, like what does adoption look like and what does the journey look like? I think, you know, people talk a lot about customer journey, and I think too often when they talk about journey, they mean the journey with their product. Mm-hmm. Not the customer's journey. So if I buy your software, it's not because I want your software. It's because I'm trying to do my job. I'm trying to grow my business. I'm trying to get promoted. I'm trying to get home at 5 o'clock, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's not because I want your software. And the better the company can be at aligning their marketing message, their product, their support with the customer's mission, mm-hmm. The better and deeper the relationship is going to be.
Yeah, absolutely. And oh man, you're completely speaking my language, because what I'm always talking about is the same kind of thing I'm talking about, you know, like our North Star should be about making our customers so happy and so, you know, getting whatever they care about done through using our software, not just our North Star is like sell more, you know, right. Like, ugh. Right. Yeah. So I totally get that. So do you find that there are a lot of companies out there that are already this focused on their customers' value that they're able to sort of, you know, jump in and run with that? Or do you have to convince them how to shift their thinking to be focused on, you know, creating that long-term relationship with the customer instead of the short-term wins?
So it's a good question, Holly. You know, and I'm interested in what you find as well. Mm-hmm. I find that for most companies, it's apple pie and motherhood, right? Like if you say, you know, I'm here to help you really focus on long-term relationships and on recurring revenue and engagement and deepening relationships, they're like, yeah, we're first of all, yes, of course we believe in that. And second of all, we have really great relationships with our customers. Right. And then you look at it, you look at their data and you see that a lot of people, you know, come in and go out, or, you know, failure to thrive, failure to launch on the relationship. And, you know, sometimes companies are coming to me and they're still very episodic or transactional in the way that they recognize revenue. Some of those companies, you look at it and even though they're episodic, it's like clockwork. You know, every 18 months they upgrade, every, you know, 2 years, you know, they expand by 5%, and you see, oh, wow, that looks like a membership relationship, even though there's no subscription there. Mm-hmm. And then there are subscriptions, and lots of SaaS companies fall into this, where you can tell from their numbers that they don't care at all about lifetime customer value, mm-hmm. or they are locking people in. They say they care. This is what it really comes down to, is it's easy to be all about customer relationships until you have to hit your quarterly number. And that's when you stick in a feature that you're going to charge for, you add some kind of extra cost, you decide to postpone implementing some kind of benefit that you know your customers really need, because that will allow you to hit your short-term number. And interestingly, something that I found is a lot of the best membership-oriented businesses, the ones that have the most long-term focus, are often closely held family-owned businesses. Bootstrapped businesses, because number one, they don't have investors breathing down their neck about hit this number. And number two, the leadership team is not going anywhere and their name might even be on the door. And so legacy, reputation, relationship matters to them, I would say a lot more than these, you know, people that are kind of going, you know, 3 years here, 5 years there, 2 years there, hit my number, move on. That yeah. long-term focus requires a long-term focus of the employee team as well.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting insight that, you know, it brings me back. One of my favorite conversations I've had was when I talked to Tim O'Reilly about the growth patterns of Silicon Valley and the sort of impacts that just the incentive structure has and the way that people are working, trying to hit those big numbers that the investors want to see, but they're cannibalizing their long-term prospects. Yeah. You know, along the way, because they're just doing it for the short-term win. And I think what you just described is absolutely right. It's exactly the same thing that I see. And, you know, I've been in companies too, where even the 3 year or 5 year sounds long, you know, like where the C-suite is rotating in and out less than a year per person, you know, and you're just like, whoa, how could anybody be looking at a long-term impact here if that's how long they last?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah. So when people start to get caught up on a short-term thing, how do you bring their attention back to the long-term?
Yeah. Well, so I think the first thing is just what you said, which is point it out to them and point out that sometimes you have to make that choice and give them the tools to make that choice deliberately. And so you can say to them, look, here's what's going to happen. If you hide the cancel button, if you lock your subscribers into a 3 year term and you don't invest in engaging them over that 3 year term in such a way that you're 100% confident that they're going to stay after renewals, they're going to leave. And so you really have to show them, I think you have to show them the numbers. You have to explain it kind of in a logical way, sort of like, why would they, if they're not expanding, if they're not using these features, how are they recognizing value? And what would be the argument that they're making for why they should stay with you? And I think then sort of people start to come around on those things. For me personally, as a consultant, I start with, you know, we're talking about a long-term, this is a long-term game. And if that's not interesting to you, I don't want to work with you, right? That's not like sometimes when COVID happened, people actually called and said, hey, recurring revenue seems to really be the thing that's working. Those companies seem to be more resilient. I need to get that right now. Can you do that very quickly? And it's
what did you say?
I said, actually, it's the exact opposite of doing it quickly is what I said. I said, you know, this is the long-term strategy. However, now is a really good time to begin planting the seeds. But it's sort of like saying, oh my God, I'm hungry. I heard you have seeds. I love apples. Can you give me some seeds so I can eat some apples because I'm starving? It's like, well, no, but actually this is good planting season. And so why don't we plant them now so that this doesn't happen again? And so some organizations did go with that and other organizations went back to their kind of frenetic promotion-based, you know, big sale before the end of the quarter kind of mindset. But a lot of organizations are accelerating their transformation to a longer term approach because of COVID, because of this disruption.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Are there any stories that you can share of an organization that's doing that you've been seeing?
Yeah, so I can give a couple of examples. I won't say the names of the organizations because they're kind of in the middle of this. But one of them is a major grocery chain in Latin America, and they've had people. You know, they have an email list. They have some delivery, but during this time, suddenly what they were thinking of as this membership where you get, you know, free, not free delivery, but included, you know, you pay a monthly fee, you get your delivery included. You get some other benefits as well. Suddenly that moved to the front of the line and the tech investment that's not insignificant suddenly moved to the front of the line and, you know, made it to the top three for the board and the CEO of this, you know, multinational, you know, multi-chain organization. So that was really interesting to see this slow-moving organization just pivot towards subscription. I've seen lots of examples in the learning space. There's all kinds of businesses of all sizes, and I've worked with several of them that have some kind of content, anything from a university, like a four-year college with a full, you know, graduate schools around it, to professional development organizations that do trainings, moving really rapidly. You know, with many of them have invested a lot in physical plant, in having training rooms, in having physical, you know, facilitators and process visuals that are, you know, booklets, and seeing them also just rapidly move, make a sort of sharp left turn. That's been interesting as well. And then, of course, we're seeing it with gyms and fitness centers that are figuring out how to stream, not just stream the class, but also go the other way and give you feedback like, hey, you're not lifting your leg high enough. You know, I know you can do heavier weight, Robbie, you know, but that the technology was there 10 years ago, but companies were slow to move. It's very hard to move an organization that has found, like I always say, the problem, a lot of businesses is when they launch, they're very visionary and they're ruled by the vision. And then they build a product and then they become ruled by the product. And 5 years later, 10 years later, 15 years later, if they were starting fresh with the same vision, they would build a totally different product. But because of their history, they keep tinkering with the old product instead of starting fresh or really focusing on the problem they're solving. So like in the world of news, that's newspapers, right? Today, if you were starting a business where your goal was to help people understand the world around them so they can make better decisions,
yeah,
you wouldn't do it with a newspaper.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
But they're kind of hamstrung by their printing presses and their distribution mechanisms. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to make that move because they're so product centric. They're not really customer centric.
Yeah. Oh, I've seen the same thing you're describing so many times, you know, working in a lot of tech platforms where, you know, even 5 years later, the product that you would create to solve this problem maybe has a lot of different things under the hood, a lot of different, you know, guts to how it works, even if it's all still digital. And there's so much inertia. It's so difficult to get people to let go of the pieces of the product that they're built with their blood, sweat, and tears, right? Like that, you know, you'd be like, it doesn't matter to the customer anymore. But right. They're like, well, it matters to me.
Right. And they don't even, you know, it's funny because people won't even, like, it's hard to even get people to say that. Like if you come around to the fact that you say, but I made this and I don't want to get rid of it. I'm feeling sentimental, right? Then at least mm-hmm. you can deal with that issue. But usually what they'll say is, customers need this feature. They love this feature. The people want this feature, right? Yeah. And like one kind of crazy example of that, I was working with a big professional association mm-hmm. and they're on a very tight budget. They really wanted to invest in this digital community and digital training and educational resources. Mm-hmm. But we had to find money from different places. And I said, well, what about this line item for fax machine and fax guy? Like they had a fax person who did faxing. And they said,
wow.
Well, one of the people on our board really loves getting everything via fax. He doesn't have a computer. And, you know, and I said, well, that's one person. I mean, he's important because he's on the board, but you know, he should understand that that's not in the best interest for the business. And then they say, but the fax guy says it's really important and people love it when, you know, John sends the faxes. Everybody loves John, the fax guy. And I said, well, John, the fax guy should become whatever, John, the email guy, John, the Slack guy, John, the, you know, and they were like, well, John doesn't want to do that. And it was like,
wow.
It was like, well, I mean, you know, and I feel so mean, but I was like, well, then maybe John shouldn't work for you anymore. Maybe John,
yeah.
If John, I mean, that's his choice. If he doesn't, if you're willing to train him or if you're willing to let him train himself to do, you know, email instead of fax or whatever, and he chooses not to, you know, sometimes just pointing out what's happening and putting words to it can be really powerful for, because I don't think, you know, when you say it, people are like, oh, well, that sounds ridiculous. Yeah, of course. But,
yes.
But they're like, but we love John and John's been here for 20 years and John likes to use the fax machine and, you know, Mike, our board member, loves getting the faxes and, mm-hmm. you know.
Wow. That's just an incredible story, but it illustrates it so well. People do behave like that and get attached to the thing that's going on and not want to change and, you know, rationalize it. So what do you do when you're working with a client that says that they want all the benefits of, you know, membership, of long-term relationship focused things, but then their behavior is harder to bring along. What are some of your favorite techniques to get them on board and help them get through it?
Yeah, it's a good question. So 5 years ago, I wrote The Membership Economy to say to people, look, membership is power. You know, when you have a member mindset, when you think about your customers as belonging to you and depending on you and having expectations from you, and that you're going to have a long-term relationship with them, it changes everything and it allows you to justify recurring revenue or subscription pricing, which does all kinds of amazing things for your business model. You know, recurring revenue, predictable cash flow, better valuations, all of those things. And so, you know, hey, company, you should consider this really amazing approach, right? That was the first book. And, you know, 5 years later, I don't have to do that. Everybody wants that. A lot of them start with, I want the subscription revenue, not I want to have a long-term focus on my customers and treat them really well and build relationships with them and support their ongoing goals and be on their journey with them. And so I come into this situation a lot where the focus is on getting the subscription revenue and locking in the customer. And, you know, I've had talks with UX teams where they're talking about how they've layered in two more steps into whatever the cancel process, and that's actually adding 6 weeks to the average. And they're saying it with pride, right? Because they're saying, well, we actually just did a major overhaul of the, you know, cancel, you know, process, and it's really effective. We're actually retaining people for an extra month. And I'm like, what do you mean you're retaining them for next month? Because they got so frustrated because they could only cancel on Tuesdays. So how do I deal with that? One is I'm really upfront about that's not how I work, and that it starts with the mindset. And that's why I don't call this, like, I don't talk subscription first. I talk membership first, because it's about that mindset. And if the company, I always say, if you're not having a member mindset, you're going to fail. So that's kind of the first thing. The second thing that I try to encourage organizations to do is to start at the bottom of the funnel. So, you know, in the membership economy, the transaction is the starting line, not the finish line for most people's jobs. So the marketers, right? Yeah, sure, you do a little marketing to get that, you know, person to be aware of you and get to that moment of transaction. But the heavy lifting for marketing is, how do we market them on the idea, or how do we build a relationship with them so that they use our products and so that they share our products with their colleagues or their friends and they go deeper and they buy more? How do we do that, right? That becomes a marketing question as well. Same with the product. It's not just about what's the headline feature that, you know, which feature has got the big ROI. It's which feature is going to drive retention. And so really starting at the bottom of the funnel and saying, before we turn on our loudspeaker, our marketing loudspeaker, are we confident that when someone joins, they're going to stay for a long time? Because if they're not going to stay for a long time, don't bother bringing anyone into your leaky bucket. Sometimes that language, it's not as offensive or as upsetting to that CEO who's saying, you know, let's go for the short-term revenue. You say, look, this is what's going to happen. If you focus on acquisition, you'll look really good this quarter, and next quarter, you'll have nothing. Also, you'll have a bad reputation because people will talk and they'll say, oh, I tried that and I canceled because it never worked, or I never used it, or it didn't do what they promised, or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really, really fascinating and helpful. I think that one of the things that I'm curious about is, how do people know if the customer is going to stay? How do they know, you know, whether they're ready to make that investment in the marketing because customers are going to be good long-term customers, or that they're not ready?
Yeah. People ask this all the time because, you know, if you have a 36-month retention, you know, if you say, you know, we think they're going to stay for somewhere between 36 and 48 months, 3 or 4 years, and you're on a monthly cadence, that seems like a long time to wait before you invest. Yeah, I don't want to wait 4 years before I invest in marketing. Most of the time, in a monthly subscription, you can tell in about 3 months what the curve is going to look like. You know, most subscription businesses track their data in cohorts, both cohorts by when the person signed up and also by what channel they signed up through. and sometimes by other factors as well. And that way they can start to see, oh, in month one or in period one, you know, we have 93% retention. In period two, we have 95% retention. And in periods three, four, and five, we have 97% retention. And that's a very good, of course, that's very good retention, but it usually looks like that. Your worst cliff is usually in month one, and it's a failure to launch problem. You know, I often encourage companies, like, if you don't have a failure to launch problem, if people stay past the first pay period, that's a really good indicator that you're onto something. In a B2B company where, let's say, they have an annual, those metrics might be more around onboarding. Mm-hmm. So I really encourage companies to understand the difference between a successful onboarding and an unsuccessful one, and to really look at, like, say, okay, here's all your best customers. Here's all your not best customers, not your worst customers, but just not best ones. And what are the differences that you can identify between how those different businesses found you, what mm-hmm. their onboarding experience was, and how they expanded over time? And you start to see all these best practices. And then you mm-hmm. go back and build those into your process, whether that's with your customer success team. So how do we onboard them? Whether it's with your sales team to say, hey, don't, you know, back to what we were talking about earlier, don't acquire this customer. If they don't meet these criteria, they're not going to stay. So don't bother, because you're just, you know, gunking up the gears, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, you want the metrics to be shared by, you know, sales and customer success and marketing and product should all be sharing some of the same metrics mm-hmm. because it's often not obvious whose fault it is, right? we've all seen that, right? But you want the product team to build in an onboarding flow once you know what it is. So in the world of, like, streaming content, one of the kind of things that a lot of these organizations have realized is that if you bring somebody, a new customer in, the most important attributes of onboarding that line up with long-term relationships are, did they look at multiple types of content, and did they figure out how to get their content from their smartphone to their big screen TV, to their mm-hmm. smart TV? And if they've done those two things, so if you came in to watch Hamilton, mm-hmm. but then you stuck around for the Disney princesses and the National Geographic, you know, specials, you are much more likely to stay than I am if all I did was watch Hamilton and maybe half of The Sound of Music, which was what they recommended to everybody who sat through 3 hours of Hamilton, which is kind of crazy. but, you know, that those two actions are very good predictors of engagement. Mm-hmm. So even if you don't have 14 months of data, you can say, oh, if they're watching on their smart TV and they're using, you know, comedies and documentaries and movies and Bollywood and what have you, they're getting the value. And the reason is they're getting the value they're paying for. They've made it a habit when their enthusiasm is still high. So that means that I'm pretty confident they're going to stay.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a great example. So it's really finding that those most engaged customers, and what are those actions that they're taking along the way to becoming so engaged, and how can you track those, you know, early and use that? That's fantastic. Yeah, now I'm like, oh, what else should I be watching on Disney Plus?
It's better than you think. I mean, a Disney Plus is better than you think. Like, that's the interesting thing, right? You think, like, everybody's like, well, I'm not going to stay with Disney Plus after I watch Hamilton because I don't watch princess movies. Mm-hmm. But they have all of these great action titles. They have all of this National Geographic content. They have this ESPN content. Like, they have a lot of more than you'd think. And it's the job of the product team to surface that other content. And to help somebody find, I mean, this is always the problem, right? Is it's like you go to the party, right? And you walk in the front door and you don't know where to go, right? Mm-hmm. You don't know that there's a, you know, if you go down into the basement and make a left, there's a band over there, right? That's really good. And so you turn around and you leave, you know, before you even saw the good stuff. And so I think it's often the job of the product team to help you, to welcome you into the lobby, and then maybe to walk you down to say, you look like the kind of person that enjoys country music. Let me take you down through the maze of rooms and show you where our awesome band is.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. Are there any other key lessons that we haven't covered that you feel are really important for a product person to know about the membership economy and the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think we sort of touched on it, but I think that the element of culture is really important in mm-hmm. subscription. And a subscription business feels different than an episodic or transactional one. And one of the big things that you feel is that long-term focus. Another one is that the functional areas aren't as siloed. It's really important, you know, if you're truly aligned around a customer journey, then that means that the experience that they're getting from the marketing materials that tell them, that kind of build awareness, to the experience of the actual sale, that one-to-one experience, to how they onboard and learn how to use your products and make them a habit, to how they stay, to how they're supported when they have a problem, all of those pieces have to fit together. And I think one of the real challenges right now with COVID is that, you know, you're not even bumping into your colleagues from other departments at the lunch table, right? You have your meetings with your product team or, you know, your work team, but it's really important, I think, to stay connected to the customer and to your colleagues and their interactions with the customer. As organizations move to subscription, they really have to think hard about what's the culture, what are the shared metrics, what is the one metric that everybody's going to pay attention to this quarter, mm-hmm. and how do you build that kind of mindset across the organization?
Yeah, you're totally right. And building that collaboration across those disciplines is something that I've certainly seen is challenging in most places, right? Like it's so easy for companies to silo and for teams to say, oh, that's that team's problem, or that's the team whose fault that is. Yeah. You know, I did my part, and then when I handed it off, they dropped the ball.
Yeah. Oh, can I share a story?
Yeah, please.
I think it's sort of funny. I think it's very funny, actually, or very interesting. Mm-hmm. So I was working with a streaming content company mm-hmm. in Europe. One of the pieces of content that they provided was sports events, live sports events, live streaming of, you know, important sports events that people care about. They also provided, you know, new release content, movies and TV programming that was very popular in this region. And they called me in because the CEO said, we're having a retention problem. And we're probably going to fire, you know, I think we need to fire our retention team. So they had an acquisition team and a retention team and a product team and a, mm-hmm. You know, customer support team, everything you can imagine. So we got everybody around the table. The project was called retention. Like, that's why I was there. Mm-hmm. And we talked, I said, let's go through the list of all the reasons that people cancel. So they had, mm-hmm. you know, from their NPS, they had all the reasons. And the number one reason that people canceled was because in the middle of the soccer game, the technology conked out. They did not have reliable streaming, right? Mm. So you're like, is that really the retention team's problem, right? That the technology conks out and people call the retention team and say, hey, you know, I was watching, I had all my friends over and the game stopped. It mm-hmm. was so embarrassing and it was so frustrating and it ruined our time, right? Is that the retention? Like, how do you win back that, right?
Yeah.
Second most common reason that people canceled was because there was a very, very popular title, like think Hamilton, mm-hmm. and they had it. And the advertising team said, join us, see our big title, get a 1 month free subscription.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what do you think people did? Everybody joined, got their 1 month free subscription, watched, you know, the European equivalent of Hamilton mm-hmm. and canceled before the first payment.
Yep.
Now, I would argue that part of the fault there was the marketing team for mm-hmm. for the way that they marketed it. They didn't market, hey, we have all these great titles and Hamilton is one of them. And then the second team that I would pick on is the product team, because mm-hmm. they weren't surfacing other content in that first month to make this. We know that people are coming in thinking they're going to cancel. So you have to surface other content, make the habits, get them engaged before the end of the month. And so anyway, I think that's just a really useful example of how all the teams have to work together mm-hmm. and how retention is everybody's business.
Yeah, absolutely. And just out of curiosity, what was the people who were on the team that was actually called the retention team? What skills What discipline
was that? Customer success. It was like it was on the consumer side. It was customer support. They created campaigns, so they mm-hmm. They managed the people who answered the phones. Mm-hmm. You know, hi, I want to cancel. Hi, I want to cancel. Hi, I'm so mad. I can't believe your technology doesn't work. And they also sent, like, they created those campaigns, like, hey, mm-hmm. we love you. Come back to us. Or mm-hmm. we haven't heard from you in a while. Please stay. Or, you know, those kinds of sort of marketing-ish campaigns. They had those two functions.
Yeah. Yeah, that totally makes sense. They were not the major players there that weren't getting it done. There's a lot of factors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's just so important that the org, you know, it's, I totally understand the value of having the product people sit with product people and the marketing people sit with marketing people. But I also feel like periodically you want to just switch that up and make sure that people get to know each other and understand, you know, to have opportunities to sort of take a step back and see, you know, they always talk about that, you know, all the blind people touching the elephant, like see mm-hmm. what the elephant looks like.
Yeah, absolutely.
The whole process.
Oh, that's completely right. So before we run out of time, I always like to ask people if they have any advice for somebody who's, you know, earlier on in their path. So I think, you know, for somebody who's either a product person or a founder who's early on in the path of making a subscription or membership, you know, really succeed, what would you tell them? What's the best thing that they should know?
I think get really clear on your strategy. This sounds so basic, but understand what your vision is. So, you know, most companies are really good at that, you know, world domination in 5 years, right?
Yes.
And right. So we all have our vision of our flavor of how we're going to dominate everything. And then you go all the way back to step one and you say, what's our first step to get there? What's our second step to get there? And what's our third step to get there? And I think it's important, first of all, to have at least three steps mapped out. You can't know all the steps because life is so uncertain. But at least, but what happens a lot of times is you have one step and you get through the one step and you don't know what the second step is and you lose your momentum. Mm-hmm. So you have to kind of keep pushing and keep aiming. And when you're choosing those first steps, be really clear on what you need to learn that will give you the leverage to go to the next step. So in the cases of a lot of, you know, private bootstrap venture-backed companies, if you're bootstrapped, you're like, one of the things I have to do is generate some revenue or I have to turn off the lights and stop. So mm-hmm. then your focus might be much more narrow where you say, okay, I'm going to figure out who's willing to pay right now. And that's my first experiment. If you have really deep pockets, you might say, I have a little runway. The most important thing for me to figure out is if people will use this product as I expected, which is more of what, let's say, Spotify did. Right? They weren't as worried about making money. They were like, will people get rid of their big collections of DVDs or not DVDs, but whatever the
CDs.
Yes. It's been a while. you know, that was the most important step. So really understand, you know, in other cases, the question is I need to have leverage so that I can get the partners that I want to do what I want them to do. So really be clear on like, okay, this step needs to happen first. And I'll know I'm successful if I'm able to do that, if I'm able to get more money, if I'm able to make my partners want to join me, if I'm able to get my customers to change their behaviors. And, you know, so it's that constant balance of your telescope looking out on the horizon mm-hmm. and your microscope looking at the product and the customers you're serving today.
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. I also love that you ended with telescope and microscope because it goes so well with our theme. awesome. So thank you so much for your time today. Where can people find you if they want to follow you?
Yeah, RobbieKelmanBaxter.com. My name is probably the easiest place to find me. And you can find my books on anywhere you buy books, The Membership Economy and The Forever Transaction. And I just launched a podcast of my own that is very focused on subscription stories. So that's another place to if you're a subscription nerd like me, we go pretty deep on mm-hmm. subscriptions every week.
Fantastic. Oh, well, thank you again so much. This was a really fun conversation and I'm sure our listeners are going to love it.
Yeah, it was great talking to you, Holly. Thanks so much for having me.
Product Science Podcast is brought to you by H2R Product Science. We teach startup founders and product leaders how to use the product science method to discover the strongest product opportunities and lay the foundations for high-growth products, teams, and businesses. Learn more at h2rproductscience.com. Enjoying this episode? Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss next week's episode. I also encourage you to visit us at productsciencepodcast.com to sign up for more information and resources from me and our guests. If you love the show, a rating and review would be greatly appreciated. Thank you.